Okay, today I thought I'd tie up a few loose ends and then take a few questions and then continue with the class. These are some points I didn't get to, and they're not in any particular order, okay? There was a question about the first five perfections helping the last perfection, and the last perfection helping the first perfection, and the first five perfections not deserving the name perfection unless they had the sixth perfection. And this raises a bunch of different questions. I think one of the nicest questions is that I used to struggle with is there any order to the six perfections? Why do they put them in that order? You see what I mean? And is there some kind of logical sequence to the six perfections? And it's not very evident, but you can find it in books like Gelsop Jay's commentary on Master Shantideva's Bodhisattva Guide to the Way of Life. Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, okay? So I'm going to give you a very quick rundown of why they come in that order, and that will help you appreciate why number six helps the rest and like that, okay? So what's the first one? Giving. And giving implies that you don't have a great attachment to the objects that you possess. Okay, so it's a kind of an expression of you don't have attachment to your possessions, or you wouldn't be able to give them up very easily. And that flows naturally into, you see, the second perfection, which is what? Morality. Especially, you know, not stealing things, not hurting other people to get their things or their wife or their position in the office or something like that, okay? So having the lack of attachment to your possessions in the first perfection leads naturally to the second perfection, which is morality. Morality is a kind of, learning to restrain yourself. In Tibetan, the word for vow is samaya, is It means to domba. Domba means to restrain yourself, to tie yourself, to bind yourself, okay? So morality is a kind of restraint. You don't get to practice morality until you have a strong desire to do something wrong, and then you restrain yourself. You see what I mean? And that is morality. So morality involves a kind of self-restraint. What's the third perfection? Yeah, art of not getting angry, let's say. Just for, you know, argument's sake. And that requires a lot of restraint. See what I mean? So the ability to restrain yourself flows naturally into the art of not getting angry. Okay. Fourth one? Joyful effort. The art of not getting angry requires a lot of, how should we say? I forgot this one. Let me see. Let me come back to that one. I don't remember it. Okay. Joyful effort is something you have to practice all the time, day and night. Okay? It's a thing that you do day and night, that you have to be happy about your good deeds. And ultimately, if you're very good at joyful effort, you're staying up most of the night, okay? I mean, I asked my lama when I first met him, is there any way I can not sleep? And he said, no. And then later, I found out, just by experience, that if you really enjoy something, you don't feel like sleeping, and then you don't need sleep so much. Enjoyment or concentration is a kind of nutrition or a kind of sustenance in the way that sleep is. So the concentration can replace the sleep, okay? So in that sense, it can lead into number five, which is meditation. Meditation is the ability to be one-pointed about something all the time. And at number four, you develop the ability to be joyful all the time, and that's a kind of one-pointedness all the time. And then they say that leads into concentration, which is a one-pointedness. So joyful effort involves a kind of one-pointedness, and meditation is an expression of that one-pointedness. So that's how that one flows into that. And then obviously, you've got to reach the platform of shamatha to be able to see emptiness directly, especially. And that's how number five flows into number six. I forget the one between three or four, but I'll check it and I'll bring it to you. Okay, I slips my mind right now. Okay. Yeah, I can't. There's a special explanation. I don't remember it. Now, there's a catch 22 because they say it doesn't get the call. The first five don't get to be called perfections until you do them with wisdom. But you've got to do the first five to get wisdom, according to this order. Okay, so that's how, here's how they explain that. Can you read? The word perfection in Sanskrit is paramita, and in Tibetan is parotuchimba. Okay. It's something else. It's close to that, but I gotta look it up. Say paro to chimba. Paro to chimba. Paro means the other side, like the other side of a river or the other side of an ocean. Okay? In Sanskrit, that's para. Okay? Then to means to the other side. In Sanskrit, that locative is m, param. And then chimba means gone. And in Sanskrit, that's itta. So it's param itta. Or in English, paramita. Okay? All right. And perfection. Now, I used to wonder, you know, why they call it perfection, okay? Legally speaking, technically speaking, if you do giving with an intention to become a Buddha to help other people, even if you don't have real bodhicitta yet, okay, which is very difficult to have, right? Even if you're just a plain old person who heard about bodhicitta and bodhisattva and love and compassion and trying to become a Buddha for other people, if you do your giving with that kind of attitude, it becomes the paramita of giving. Okay? Technically speaking, legally, in the Bodhisattva Charavatara and elsewhere, when you do it with even a kind of a forced or an artificial bodhicitta, which is all that most of us have, okay, then that thing can be called a perfection. Because you're doing it with some kind of bodhicitta. It's called the chöpa. Chöpa means it's forced or it's artificial in a way. You don't have real bodhicitta yet, but you're trying to act like a bodhisattva. If you notice in Master Shantideva's book, he keeps calling us bodhisattvas. You bodhisattvas who are reading this book, he's just being nice. You see, he's just saying, you attempted bodhisattvas. Okay? And that's what... If you do an action, technically, with that kind of attitude, even if it's not very strong, and even if you're not very convinced of it, and even if it's not from your heart exactly, it's still a perfection of giving, for example. Okay, so technically, it's not true what the Buddha said when he said, if you do the act of giving without, number six, without an understanding of emptiness, don't call it a perfection. Okay, so then the question arises, you know, in the debate ground, well then why did the Buddha say that? Okay. I'll say it again. If you do giving with some kind of pretty good attitude, even if it's not real bodhicitta yet, we can call that the perfection of giving. But Buddha comes along and says, don't call it perfection of giving until you do it with an understanding of emptiness. Okay? This comes to the real meaning of paro to chimba. Because obviously they're not perfect, right? You're just an attempted bodhisattva, and you're trying to give some stuff away to other people, and you're trying to have bodhicitta, but you don't have bodhicitta. So how can we call it a perfection? Okay? And this is how, you have to understand that the word perfection is an abbreviation. It's an abbreviation for something longer. Okay? Just erase PA, MPA. Now there's a new part here. I took out the ba and I put J. Before we had perfection. When you add che in Tibetan, which means to do, okay, you come out with perfectionizer. Okay? I just made up a new word. Okay? It's a perfectionizer. And those six actions done by one of us is gonna make you perfect later. So the real word for those is paro chin che, which means that which makes you perfect later. You see what I mean? And the word perfection is just sort of, what should you call it? Being optimistic. Okay, it's not a perfection yet. It's just an attempt by an attempted bodhisattva. But it can lead you to Buddhahood. So we call it a perfectionizer, paro chin che. Okay. But there's one element that if you don't have, it's not gonna be a perfectionizer. Which is what? Understanding of emptiness. Okay, that's where, that explains the answer to that homework question. Okay, the reason Lord Buddha said, Don't call those things the perfection of giving if you don't do them with an understanding of emptiness, even though they are the perfection of giving as soon as you do them with a good motivation, is that they won't get you there, okay, until you do them with an understanding of emptiness. Until you understand the pen thing about your arm, and unless you're giving pens away to rob, because you want your arm to turn into Manjushri's arm, it won't work. It doesn't do much, okay? It can't get you there by itself, okay? So for it to do what the name implies, which is to make you perfect, make you a Buddha, if you don't have wisdom, it's not going to make it, okay? So we're not going to give it the name perfection, says Buddha. He's on strike. Bant karo. You know, I refuse to give this the name perfection unless you're doing it with an understanding of emptiness. Because technically, although it is a perfection, since you have the right motivation, it's not going to get you to perfection. Okay? That's the point. That's how you answered that homework about 2 days ago. Okay. Now you get into another sticky question. If the first five paramitas are going to trigger number six, then how can I do the first five with number six? Okay? And this is a question of degree. Okay? You need a lot of good karma to understand emptiness. I can teach karma, I can teach emptiness to 100 people in a room. 30 of them are blanked out, and you can see it, you know, they're like, yeah, they're looking at the tea and the cookies, you know. And then, you know, 30 of them are trying to concentrate, but not doing very well. And then 30 of them are wired, you know, 30 of them are, they laugh at the right places, and they nod at the right places, you know. You don't know what it looks like from here. Okay, so that's just their karma. You see, I mean, you've got to have extraordinary good karma, A, to want to learn about emptiness, B, to get it when someone's teaching you about emptiness, okay? And that's the first five perfections. You've got to have the karma of the first five to get to number six. So the idea is, do the first five at a pretty decent level, you know, with a pretty good motivation. Give things to people wanting to turn into a tantric deity so you can show them how to do it later, which is bodhicitta. And then do the second one, do the third one, do the fourth one, do the fifth one. And because of that, the next time you go to a teaching on emptiness, it'll be, oh wow, I finally get it, okay? Finally I got it. Then you go backwards and take that understanding of emptiness and pump up the first five again. And it's just a continual upward spiral, okay? Samsara itself is a downward spiral. Why? By the way, samsara means downward spiral, korwa, okay? The word means downward spiral. Why? Boss comes in and yells at me. Due to my past yelling, I yell back. Due to that, I have to see him again. Due to that, I yell again. Due to that, I see him again. Due to that, I yell again. And it's just, that's what korwa means. That's what samsara means. The natural reaction of a being stuck in the broken desire realm is to react to something bad with the exact emotion that would make that thing happen again. It's like ironic. Like if you wanted to collect, if you wanted this guy to come back into your life and yell at you again, there's only one way to do it, which is what? Yell at him. And what's the normal reaction of a person stuck in the desire realm? By the way, which is why you're stuck in the desire realm. You only get to be here if you act this way, you see what I mean? You yell back, which is the very most stupid thing you can do. It is the stupidest thing you can do, because he's going to come back again and yell at you, and you're going to yell at him again, and there's this downward cycle. Okay, that's a samsaric downward cycle. Okay, spiral. We're talking here about an upward spiral. You follow the first five perfections, and then the next time you go to an emptiness teaching, you get it. You take that understanding, apply it to the first five, and then your wisdom gets even stronger. And then it's an upward spiral like that. Okay, so that's how the five support the one and how the one supports the five. Okay. There was another interesting question that I didn't cover in the class about karma. Okay, Chone Drapa Shirdup in his commentary says, by the way, karma is a little tricky because at the present time, the seed that you collected in your mind, meaning let's say the action, let's say you yelled at somebody in 1993 and then in 2000 you got yelled at by somebody, okay? And let's say you yell back again, okay? And let's just say it's 1999. You yelled at them in 1993, someone's going to yell at you in 2000, And we're sitting in, let's say we're sitting in December 99, okay? And in December 1999, does the action of yelling at them in 1993 exist or not? No, it's gone. It's past, okay? And you can't go find it. It's gone, okay? It doesn't exist anymore, okay? And does the getting yelled back at in January, or let's say March 2000, does it exist yet? Say, no, it doesn't exist yet. So how can we say that karmic causes and consequences, how can we say that actions and their consequences exist? Because by the time you got the consequence, where's the action? It's got to be gone, okay? By the time, at the time you have the original bad karma deed, where's the future consequence? It didn't come yet. Okay, so in that sense, they don't exist. Okay, in that sense, past and future doesn't exist. Now, Madhyamika Prasangika. By the way, to study time, which is very interesting in Buddhism, and it's in the Abhidharma Kosha and it's in the study of Chang'e, but if you think about it, the future does exist as a projection of the future. See what I mean? You do have a concept of something going to happen, and that exists now. Okay? The idea that something in the future will happen exists now. And the memory or something, the object of memory, which is, you know, something that happened a year ago, exists now. That memory exists now, and the object of it, which is only a mental image of what happened before, exists now. And the Prasangika says, if you think about it, okay, this is a lower level. If you think about it, I always think of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. You know, in America, that's a big deal. When Abraham Lincoln was killed, you know, that assassination is still affecting America. You see what I mean? That the fact that he was killed is still having ramifications now, in a very subtle way. Okay, if he hadn't been killed, things would be different in 2001. You see what I mean? And in that sense, that event, which has already passed, is a thing in the present time because it's causing results in the present time. Get it? It is past. And in a sense, it doesn't exist anymore. But if it hadn't happened, something else would be happening now. Things would be different. It is still having its effect on the present time. You see what I mean? The fact that Lord Buddha got enlightened under this tree is gone. But the fact that he did get enlightened is still affecting our... It's why this talk is happening. You see what I mean? So in that sense, that enlightenment is affecting the present, and so it's active in the present. You see what I mean? The event is gone, and it's affecting the present, so it must exist in the present in some way to be causing a result in the present. You see what I mean? And that's some of the arguments about that. Now I'll give you the more subtle explanation. Okay. When you talk, say, about your mind, okay, you hear certain thoughts in your mind. Let's say, I'd like a break, okay? You know, I wish he would stop right now and we could have tea earlier than he ever had it before, okay? Like this thought comes through your mind, okay? This D, these I's, the A's, the R, the K, the B goes through your head. And in your mind, organizes it into a thing called a thought. Okay? Due to your past karma. Okay? Due to your past karma. Alright? Your mind, forced by your past karma, organizes these sounds into a coherent thought that sounds to you like, I'd like a break. Okay? And you call that your mind. You call that your thoughts. Okay? We give that the name thoughts. I'd give a penny for your thoughts, Vilma. And she says, okay, I'll take the penny, and it was, I'd like a break. Okay, that was my thoughts. And you give it the name thoughts. Okay, but if you think about it, you got four different words here. Okay, and by the time you said break, where was the I'd? Gone. Okay, it was gone. Or else there wouldn't be any order to the sentence. Or she'd say, I break like a. Okay, so it's got to be that the I came before and the break came later. Okay, so really, you got four parts here, and your mind is synthesizing them together and calling it a thought, in the way that you take the top of the pen and the bottom of the pen and put them together and name it pen. Your karma forces you to see it as pen. But really, it's a bunch of parts that have been put together, and then your mind impute might. No camera? No. Okay. Okay. What I'm trying to say is that your thoughts are spaced out in time in pieces, and then your karma forces you to organize them into an object. In the same way, in a static reality, you know, there's pieces of the pen that you call pen, okay? That you think of as pen. And when a dog sees the same pieces, they organize it into chewable thing because of their karma. And by the way, remember what I said. That's what makes them a dog. It's not that they're seen that way because they're a dog. It's that they're a dog because they're seeing it that way. And that makes rebirth a very frightening possibility. Okay, anyway, the way we talk about the emptiness of your mind or your thoughts is that you can always break them down, you see? You can break this down into four different events that happened one after the other. And then your mind looked at it and organized it into one thought in the same way that it organized these pieces into a pen. So when we talk about the mind's emptiness, the parts are the moments of consciousness over time. Okay, those are the parts when we talk about the emptiness of the mind, normally. Okay, and your mind is looking at those parts and saying, this is a thought. You know, I'm having this thought right now. Okay, that's the emptiness of that. It applies to time, and it applies to karma and its consequences, and it applies to what we call you over the length of your life, you see. We can say, what was Elizabeth doing in 1979, okay? We can say that. And it's not crazy, you know. You're thinking about Elizabeth not in the current moment, but you're thinking of Elizabeth over the length of her life. A word or a thought or a concept applied to many occasions of Elizabeth over many years. And you call that Elizabeth. You see what I mean? Your mind thinks of that as Elizabeth. You do the same thing with karma. You do the same thing with karma. That's why past karmic events, like lying to somebody, do exist. And the result which is going to come in the future does exist, and there's a connection between them because your mind conceives of that. Your mind perceives that connection. Is karma self-existent? Well, in one sense, it's easy to say it's not. It's easy to see that it's not because I can explain karma to people. I do this all the time. I get up and say, people say, prove karma. I say, there's only two things you have to prove. One, causes happen before results, which nobody has a problem with. Number two, causes always resemble their results. That proves karma. I mean, that proves that if you lie to somebody, you're going to get lied back to. That proves that if you kill, you will be killed. Okay. Now, I can stand up and say that. And by the way, if you were at the right level, if you had been meditating a lot and practicing a lot and your mind was ripe, and I just said these two things, you would never do a bad deed again. You would say, aha, I get it. Absolutely proof that if I kill insects, I'll get sick in the future. I understand. You don't have to say anything else. Okay. A person who has that reaction has the karma to take the these two pieces of information and perceive them as the laws of karma and its consequences. They have a perception of that onto those two pieces of information, which is correct. Okay? And then other people in the room will say, they're just like, well, could you say a little bit more, because I don't think it proves it. You know what I mean? It's a nice thought, but it doesn't like totally convince me of the laws of karma. It doesn't prove to me that if I kill bugs, I might get sick later. I don't see how that proves that. If you have that reaction, then you're not perceiving the laws of karma and its consequences. You see, this is also a projection, is what I'm saying. The laws of karma and the fact that karma makes its own results is also a projection. It's also something that your mind is forcing you to see on a certain pattern of events. Okay? And if you have very good karma, you see it. And if you don't have very good karma, you don't see it. And therefore, the laws of karma are themselves empty. Okay? Because two different people can look at the same object and see something totally different. Okay? And that's the emptiness of the laws of karma. Okay?
Sorry.
Yeah?
Isn't that, that's whether you perceive it or not. That's
yeah.
The same as whether the universe actually functions that way or not.
Yeah, you could say that.
If karma is true, then it functions that way whether you perceive it or not.
Is it true that karma functions that way whether you perceive it or not?
Well, yeah. From most of the teachings I've heard, I got that impression.
Then it seems like karma should be a self-existent thing.
Yeah, it does seem that.
We'll talk about that. But I like his question. I was wondering if anyone would catch me on that. I like that question. I'm talking about the emptiness of understanding karma or not, right? Whether or not karma could work a different way or be perceived as working a different way. I'll tell you why I think not, although I've never seen any good explanation of it, okay? Like a couple of me and my students, we've been struggling with this for years, okay? I believe it's something to do with your perception of yourself and others, okay? Like, I believe it has something to do with when you do an action towards somebody else, normally you perceive them as something other than yourself, okay? That's an artificial perception. That's an artificial boundary. I have a feeling that only people in samsara do that. But, you know, somebody asked me, why is it that things come back to you when the karma was that you did something out? You see, results come back. The karma was to do something out. You see, I mean, why is there this interchange in karma? Why do we perceive an interchange of karma? And I believe it has to do with your perception that you are separate from other people. Okay? And ultimately they say you can't get bodhicitta unless you break down that perception. And there's exercises in Master Shantideva's book to practice that. Okay. That's about all I can say. Maybe something about the perception of something as being good causes a result where you see something good. That part's easy. And the fact that it comes back to you when you've sent it out, I think, relates to the fact that you've made a division between yourself and others. Okay? I believe that's why the laws of karma are perceived the same by all samsaric beings.
So that would mean karma would only apply to beings that are in samsara, wouldn't it?
Yeah. In that kind of karma, which I would call dirty karma. And then there's a thing called pure karma, which is the way it, I think with a Buddha, goodness still leads to goodness, but the breakdown of themselves and others, because that broke down a long time before, they're experiencing limitless pleasure or limitless good, because they no longer have a perception of themselves as of their interest of being different from other people's interests. You see? I believe that's the thing, but you know, a lot of what I'm presenting here is, a lot of these questions are not very clear in scripture, you know, and I think we have to thresh them out. You know, there are certain things that over hundreds of years in Tibet, they just take for granted. Like Kedubje in 1400 said, I've never met a Tibetan who could explain why there are future lives. You know what I mean? Like he said, everyone in Tibet believes future lives. Why? Because their mom said so. You know what I mean? I've never heard a good explanation why there should be a future life. You see what I mean? And then he went ahead and took Dharmakirti's explanation. But that's another story. Okay. I don't think there's any other... I can't remember any other questions that we didn't go over, but I'd like to open the floor for questions, and then we'll do questions for a while. And... And then we'll have the class, okay? Did you? Yes, please speak loud, because other people, and I'll repeat the question. Oh, he asked a very good question, you see. Of all the things in the world, it seems like the law of karma is something that might be the same all the time, which would imply that it has some kind of nature of its own. You see, because no matter who perceives the laws of karma, they work the same for everybody. You see what I mean? It's not like this. You see what I mean? It's the same for all living beings. For all living beings, if you do something good, you get something good back. If you do something bad, you get something bad back later. It's not like some people perceive it as good action leading to a bad result or a bad action leading to a good result. It seems to be universal that everyone experiences karma the same way. That would seem to imply that karma itself, the laws of karma, are self-existent. You see what I mean? And I think it's kind of a tricky question. You have to chew on that one, I think.
What about the law of gravity?
Law of gravity is not self-existent. Okay? I mean, that's why yogis can fly. Okay? No, seriously, I'm not kidding. One thing I forgot to list yesterday with the four Arya truths is that on that day you realize that you could perform miracles. Okay? And how does a miracle happen? Once you understand emptiness, miracles are easy. Okay? Walking on water is a perception that's forced on you by your past karma. If you have that kind of karma to see, it's called in the Abhidharma. You can perceive the elements of water as element of earth and you can walk on it. You know what I mean? And that's possible due to your karma. Okay? And then if you almost had that much karma, you could see somebody walk on water. You see what I mean? And not be able to do it yourself. And a lot of tantric karma in the field of tantra is almost like instant karma. You see, karma can ripen in this lifetime, next lifetime, or thereafter. Three kinds of karma, accepted by all Buddhist schools. Tantra runs on the principle that karma can ripen immediately. You can get karma to ripen within a year, or 10 years, or 5 years. In other words, that's what makes the practice of tantra possible. And a lot of the energy of that karma is driven by belief. You see, in the open teachings, we discourage belief. In the secret teachings, belief is what runs a lot of it. So it's very interesting that the karma that can maintain a miracle and cause it to keep going on is very much tied up with the karma of believing in it. You see what I mean? And it's almost like those stories that the fairies and the trolls and the elves of Ireland couldn't exist if no one believed them anymore. You see what I mean? So anyway, the karma of believing in it is that it happens. You see what I mean? That the karma of believing in it causes it to happen. So what would happen if you got like 5 steps out into the water and you lost faith? You see what I mean? Then you'd like sink. Yeah. No, the karma maintaining the miracle would be broken. You see what I mean? And then there's the karma to see the miracle take place, which is already an amazing karma, but not enough to do it yourself. And then there's the karma of the guy who's sitting on the shore of Galilee and looks away at that moment. And they say, he hears this hubbub and he looks back and there's this guy in the water. And he's like, you know, what's the big deal? And he didn't have the karma to see it. So yeah, miracles, even the law of gravity is not, it's also a perception, and that's an easy one. That can be broken. Yeah.
Can you explain to me this course is before resource? Because you say that we speak here today because Buddha was enlightened, but couldn't someone say that he was enlightened because we speak here today?
It's an interesting thing. He said, I've mentioned this Buddhist principle, and there's only one, there's a tiny bit of one Buddhist school that says there's a cause that could come at the same time as a result, but that's another thing. Almost all Buddhist schools almost exclusively believe that causes come before the results. So he said, but isn't it true that, you know, earlier you spoke that the Buddha got enlightened and that's why we're here today. But couldn't you say that the Buddha got enlightened because we're here today? Okay. And there is such a concept in Madhyamika Prasangika. And Pabongkor Rinpoche discusses it in that book right there, which is the fact that we're here today, the event of us having this teaching today, was caused by Lord Buddha getting enlightened earlier. And in that sense, the cause was Lord Buddha getting enlightened, and the result was us having this class today. In another sense, you can call that the cause of having the class today only because we're having the class. So in that sense, having the class has been a cause for calling that the reason for the class. You see what I mean? And in that sense, the class is a cause for Lord Buddha's teaching having been a cause for the class. Okay? And that's a very typical Madhyamika Prasangika thing. And that's all. Event-wise, Lord Buddha's enlightenment caused this class. Labeling-wise, or being able to call it a cause, only occurred after we had this class. So in that sense, this class has caused Lord Buddha's teaching to be called a cause of the class. Okay? And that's just a, you know, debater's chess game. Yeah?
Sounds like we need a lot of good karma and a lot of effort to get anywhere, but in the first meditation we were asked to pray to our gurus to help us.
Yeah.
With all the effects and consequences of karma, I'm just confused as to how deities and gurus actually help us.
Yeah, it's a very good question, okay? The question is, you know, we did preliminaries in the meditation this morning and other times, and we were praying to lamas to help us, and how does that work if all this stuff is true? And it's a question that you have to ask. It's a question that you have to be concerned about. Those of you who are trying to practice Tonglen, for example, does it work, and can you really help another person? And if not, then why are we doing it? You know what I mean? And one thing that's important to say is that two living beings cannot share karma. It's impossible. You cannot share karma. Okay? In other words, I can't go out and keep my vows today and then somebody else not keep their vows. And then I, out of, what do you call it, compassion, say, okay, you can have my good karma from keeping my vows today and I'll take your bad karma of not keeping your vows and let's do it that way. Okay? That's impossible. Why that is that what you call a person is actually the ripening of one mental stream of karma. What I'm saying is that what you call you is really just a big string of ripenings from what you did before. So I can't make karma for you and give it to you. Okay, mind streams never mix together. After you get enlightened and you become a fully enlightened being, you are still a separate person from other Buddhas. It's not like all those minds meld together. Quality-wise, qualitatively, they're all the same state of mind. They're all totally equal. They know all things, and they are helping limitless sentient beings. But they are not the same mind, and they are not the same person. Okay, because karma can only be collected individually. Okay, and I always say that, you know, no matter how much and no matter how vehemently someone argues against that, I am living proof that you can't give your karma away. Okay, the fact that I have a headache, you know, which I do, okay, proves that Lord Buddha couldn't take it away. You see what I mean? It proves that the Dalai Lama can't take it away, cannot take it away. Okay, that's all. If they could take away any of my karma, let's face it, if they could take away 1 pound of karma, they can take away a ton of karma. You see what I mean? It's not for them, it wouldn't be a question of, it's a question of can they or can't they? It's not a question of how much can they. You know what I mean? And if I'm still having diarrhea, or I still have a headache, or my throat's still sore, then that proves that the Buddhas can't take away my suffering. Oh, by the way, there's one other choice, one other possibility. They somehow enjoy my suffering. You know what I mean? Somehow they think, that's okay. Let him suffer, you know. You know, I mean, so either they have the power to take away my karma or they don't. And obviously they don't because I'm here. Okay, so what's the use of going to a lama and praying to them? And why do you go to the Dalai Lama and ask him to bang you on the head when you pass by his stone? You know, what's going on here? It's a very simple answer. Your faith in them is such a good karma that you get a blessing. Okay? Your faith, you know, truly believing that this being is an enlightened being, is such a good karma that a blessing actually occurs. And it has nothing to do with what they do from their side. Okay? That's why His Holiness calls himself a dog's tooth sometimes. You know the story? You know, Joe Schmo living in Lhasa in 1890, 1890, you know, says, "Mom, I'm going to the Holy Land, to India. I hope you didn't have to take the same road from Varanasi." And Mom says, "Don't forget to get me a Buddha bone, you know, a relic from the Buddha, and bring it home, you know." And he goes to India. He has a good time. I bet he didn't even go to Varanasi. He probably went to Delhi to some, I don't know. Anyway, and then he went home. And, you know, a mile from home, he remembers that Mom told him to get a bone, a Buddha's, you know, relic. So he sees a dead dog and a skeleton, and he pulls one of the teeth out of the dog's mouth, and he wraps it in this golden cloth, and he puts a red ribbon around it, and he comes home, and he says, "Mom, I got it," you know, and she puts it on the altar, and she prays to it, and the faith of her, the karma of her faith makes her an arhat. You know what I mean? And that's why His Holiness is always out of modesty. He's saying, "I'm just a dog's bone, you know. You think I'm generating? Okay, you collect good karma with me. But, you know, I'm just a schmuck. You know, I'm just a plain old guy, you know." And that's why sometimes he says, "I'm just a dog's bone, a dog's tooth," you know, because what he's saying is that if you have enough faith in me, regardless of what I am, you will get enlightened, okay? And that's all. That's all. The karma of the faith gets you enlightened. And the karma of the faith makes a blessing happen. Okay? And the intent and the concentration of the request that you have help and knowledge from what you're visualizing is what makes it happen. Okay? And then some people come up to me and say, "Well, then I shouldn't do it." And that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Get it? I mean, to go from explaining it correctly to, "Okay, then I shouldn't do it," is, I don't know how people get that. You know what I mean? How do you get from there to there? I don't get it. You know what I mean? That means you should do it more. You see what I mean? That means you should do Donglen more. You should have more faith in your lamas because they can help you. And now you know how they really do help you. And now you know why when you went to church when you were 12 and you prayed to God that Aunt Joni would be all right, it didn't happen. Okay? I mean, that's... You can't take away other people's karma. Okay? All right? Yeah.
I understand that it's my good merit to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Like Chenrezig, yeah? I understand that. But also, the Dalai Lama Chenrezig is the 14th reincarnation, yeah?
Yeah.
And we were talking about Tulku's emanation bodies.
Yeah.
Right? So where does that stand? Is his blessing from Tulku?
I'll tell you something very interesting, okay? She's talking about His Holiness is now the 14th emanation of Chenrezig, believed to be, okay? I'll tell you something very interesting. I think it'll answer your question, okay? You've got three different Dalai Lamas going on here. There's the Dalai Lama the way he really is. There's the Dalai Lama the way the Dalai Lama sees the Dalai Lama. And there's the Dalai Lama the way you see the Dalai Lama. There's three Dalai Lamas going on here. I'll say it again. The Dalai Lama the way he really is, the Dalai Lama the way His Holiness the Dalai Lama sees His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and then there's the way you see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, okay? So, it's possible that when His Holiness gets up in the morning to brush his teeth, and he looks in the mirror, he sees this incredibly glowing, white, beautiful, incredible, you know, thousand-armed being, you know? And he's like, I mean, having trouble to cut all the fingernails and stuff, you know? That's possible. Okay, due to his karma, okay? And at the same time, for us to see this aging, beautiful, spiritual master, you know, he jokes about losing his hair and stuff like that, and, you know, and you see he's got wrinkles more, and he seems to have more trouble walking or something, and you think, and that's the Dalai Lama that you see. That's the bone, that's the chewable thing in the pen. Which is correct? I mean, it just depends on who's looking. You see, for the Dalai Lama, he's Chenrezig. For the other person, he's an aging but respected Nobel Prize winner, good man, okay? Now we get to the interesting one. The real Dalai Lama, the way he really is. Okay, where's that one? Doc, 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 doc. You know, your doc alarm should go off, you know? You know, self, nature. Self-existent thing. There ain't no such thing. That's a two-headed purple elephant that you get angry about or you get happy about who's crushing everybody in this room. There is no such thing. There is no such thing as the real way the Dalai Lama is. Get it? That's why the Heart Sutra says, there's no sounds, there's nothing to see, there's nothing to taste, there's nothing to smell. There's no Dalai Lama between the one you see and the one he sees. There ain't none. There's just a bunch of cylinders. Okay? You got to get used to that. That's emptiness. That one in the middle that's missing is emptiness. Okay? So what I mean to say is something very interesting. There could be someone in this room who has practiced their tantric practice perfectly and who is at this moment seeing everybody in this room as a tantric angel. And then there could be everybody else in this room seeing everybody else in this room as normal, even themselves. You see what I mean? The same person that you're seeing as normal, this other person is seeing as a tantric deity. Who's right? But which way is it really? You see, that's the finger in the middle. Okay? There is no such thing. There is no such thing. Get used to it. Okay, so both are valid, both are real, both work. Okay? The one person is floating all day through these deities. Ha ha, wow. You know? And this other person is like, I don't like this person I like, you know? And they're both valid and they both really exist and they both function. But which one would you rather be? You know, I mean, it's your choice. You know, they're both illusions in the sense that you're creating them with your karma, okay? But why not live in a nice illusion than a one that doesn't work so well, okay? All right? Yeah, Michael.
You mentioned the importance of the lineage. Could I say something on that, please? Because it doesn't seem to me why it's so important to have an unbroken lineage.
Oh, okay. He said, well, why is it so important to have an unbroken lineage? I think in my own case, I mean, let me explain how lineages happened, okay? You know, Michael Roach got up before a three-year retreat and gave a talk about the diamond cutter. There were so many people there, X number of people there. They all went home. Five of them started to explain it to their own friends. One of them really liked the part about the diamond experience and concentrated on that, you know? And the other one missed that teaching because they had diarrhea that night, and they liked the part about the 500 year eras of 10, because that was the simplest thing in the class. Like, that was the only thing that they didn't have to think about too hard. And so they went home and said, I'm going to give you the transmission of what Michael said at the course, you know? And they teach them about those eras, you know? And the other person goes home and says, I'll tell you what Michael said at the course, and they teach them about the direct perception emptiness. And then they teach their students, and they teach their students, and they teach their students. And this is how the four ancient schools of India began. Each person said they heard the Buddha say something different. And you can see how it happened, right? Now, what's the use of having an unbroken lineage? If you had a person who really saw emptiness directly, and they explained it pretty well to another person, you would hope that each person who passed it on, even if they didn't see emptiness directly, was very, very, very careful not to add anything and not to take out anything and not to change anything, okay? Because they might leave out the one piece of information like, you have to serve your lama to see emptiness, and then nobody could see emptiness after that. You see what I mean? Like, if this, people think spiritual things are somehow, I think of seeing emptiness directly as like a car engine, you know what I mean? And a car engine has to have certain elements in it, has to have a piston, has to have spark plugs, has to have gasoline. And then there's other parts you could leave out, the air conditioner, you know what I mean? I've run a car without a fan belt for a while, you know what I mean? It'll go for a while, you know what I mean? But there's certain parts you cannot leave out, and spiritual stuff is the same. Lam Rim is the same. Every rim in the Lam Rim is there for a reason, and if you take out a major Lam Rim, you just can't see emptiness directly, and you're not going to get enlightened. You know, it's the same as a car engine. People ask me, you know, I heard this American Indian thing, it was really interesting, and you know, they got something that's very similar to karma, and they got something that's very similar to bodhicitta. And then I say, well, how's the emptiness thing? And they say, well, frankly, they don't talk about that. And I say, well, it looks like a car engine from the outside, but it's missing the pistons. So you tell me if you want to get in this car. You know what I mean? It's got to have certain elements in it, or it may not work. You see what I mean? That's the whole idea of Lam Rim. Lam Rims are essential parts. What I say about lineage is not to leave out a major part, or it just won't work. You won't see emptiness directly. You know what I mean? And that's why the Tibetan tradition is so fantastic. I once took the Abhidhamma Kosha. We studied it for 10 years straight. And I compared every Sanskrit syllable to every Tibetan syllable. There was one difference in the whole book, you know. And the Tibetans added half a line because they couldn't get the poetry to come out right. You know what I mean? So it wasn't new information, but they just added an extra half a line. And that was the only difference. And that's how you have to pass it on. Or it might not work for the next generation. You see what I mean? That's all. Did you have a question, Tom? I think that, again, it's a question of leaving out an essential part. Like, just faith by itself is dangerous because, you know, an extraordinary amount of faith, up to a high tantric level, I believe it can cause you to reach enlightenment, okay? But it's very, very unlikely that you'd be able to have that kind of faith or to get to this correct level of faith without, for example, understanding emptiness. Like, there's no tantric text. If you read the highest tantric text of Jetsun Kapa, the most, you know, amazing, unbelievable practices you'd never even dreamed of, the first 50 pages are emptiness, you know what I mean? Because it doesn't work without understanding emptiness. And it's kind of frustrating, you know, like you want to get to the good stuff, you know, and he's got 50 pages of emptiness, and you're like, wait, I just read this in the Lama Rinpoche. Why is he saying it over again? You know, to really make this arm turn into Manjushri's arm, to understand the process will make it happen much faster and more likely. It's like knowing how to turn the computer on or not. It's true that a person sitting there all day typing in the numbers without understanding the program might come up with the right results if they push every key on the keyboard in the right order by accident. And there have been people like that. But it's not a system. It's not reliable. You don't want to trust to that. You know, you want a Lam Rim, A, B, C, D, E, get enlightened, you know? Okay. Yeah, please. And then we'll take a break, okay? Excuse me, one more thing. And then we'll do some questions again in the next session, okay? Yeah. Yeah.
And I take a rebirth. And can you give some description of what those seven lifetimes will be like, apart from how comfortable they will be?
Yeah, cool. Okay.
What can you remember?
Yes. Good. It's a very good question. It's a very often asked question. FAQ. The perception you have of those future lives is not precise enough to identify your parents or something like that. It's not like you know. In the third life, your father's name is going to be John or something like that. It's not like that. You have a general, what we call yogic perception. You have a general awareness of the fact that you will have seven lifetimes to go if you don't practice Tantra properly. If you practice Tantra properly, it'll only take this lifetime. Then you have a general perception of who the level of family, meaning, you know, you are in the top 100th of 1% of the material wealth of the world. You know, you are, out of 1,000 people, each of you is already one of the wealthiest people in the world just by having enough money to fly here and stuff like that. You will always be in that level. Now, I'm not saying that's a reason to see emptiness directly. I'm just saying your karma by that time is so good that you will always be in that level for the rest of the seven lifetimes. Your parents will always be kind. They'll always be religious. And I think the most important thing is that you will constantly be surrounded by very holy spiritual teachers from the beginning. You know, you will always be, there'll always be lamas hanging out in your house and around you and things like that. And so in that sense, everything is set. Do you remember having seen emptiness in the early years of your next life? No. Okay? There's a process called Bhaktak Sepa. Bhaktak means a mental seed in your mind. Sepa means it comes back to you. You see what I mean? And it normally would happen like between 10 or 12 or something like that, where suddenly all this information comes back to you and you remember what you saw, and you know that when you're old enough to remember consciously what you saw. So like that. It's not that you remember during the infinite years. Okay, like that. Okay, take a break, okay? And then we'll start the actual class. Okay. One last point to clear up from the other day about non-duality, okay? I mean, you see this word all the time in Buddhist scriptures. You struggle with it. It makes me very, very frustrated, okay? And I've seen many, many wrong explanations of emptiness. And you should learn emptiness correctly, and then you should be one of those people that goes around the world and cleans up all these messes created by other people explaining it wrong, okay? I mean, you should just, generally speaking, you have to respect other traditions. When the time is right and when the place is right, you should get up and say, what the hell you mean by non-duality? What's that got to do with anything? What do you mean when you say non-duality? Okay? And they'll say, subject and object aren't different. Okay? I mean, that's what they... I mean, that's the kind of thing you hear. First of all, there's no such thing as the subject and the object becoming one thing. And that's not what non-duality means. Buddha never said that. The words subject and object in Sanskrit and in Tibetan is yul and yul chen. You know, the mind is called the thing that holds the object. And the object is called the object. And never the twain shall meet. You see what I mean? There's a subject and there's an object. Emptiness doesn't mean that there's some cosmic floating together of the mind and the object. Okay, forget that. It's a fairy tale that people who can't translate made up. Okay, so is there a word non-duality in the scriptures? Yeah, there's about three different ones. What do they mean? Let's talk about it. Okay. Say nyamni. Nyamni. Nyamni means equivalent. Equivalent. Equal. Okay? The mind who sees this pen and the pen which is seen by the mind, which means the object and the subject, are equivalent, but only in one way, guess. They don't come from their own side. They're not self-existent. They lack a two-headed purple 40-foot elephant, and they don't come from their own side. That's all. Okay? In that sense, samsara and nirvana are equivalent. But God damn it, Nagarjuna never said anything else, okay? He didn't say nirvana and samsara are the same. That's a fairy tale made up by people who don't have any understanding. If the next person that says that to you, say, come over here, I got a dentist drill. And I'm going to go at your tooth. And you just perceive it as nirvana, okay? Because they're just the same. Nagarjuna said so. Okay, I've never had a single person sit for the dental drill. Okay, so nyambani means, yeah, samsara and nirvana are the same. Subject and object are the same, but only in the sense that they both don't have any self-existence. Okay, that's all. That's a no-brainer. Okay, people just forget that one. Okay, now in a deep state of meditation on the direct perception emptiness, can you be aware of your mind? Of the subject? No. Can you draw a distinction between the subject and the object? No, because one of them isn't emptiness. It's your mind. Okay? You got a square peg and a round hole. The round hole is emptiness. The square peg is the state of mind that's perceiving emptiness. Okay? And while you're seeing emptiness, he can't be aware of himself. Because his self is not emptiness. You can only perceive ultimate reality for that 20 minutes. If you think to yourself, I did it, then what happens? You pop out of it. You see what I mean? Because I did it, that sentence is not ultimate reality. You can't be aware of yourself. Yourself is a changing, positive thing. Emptiness is an unchanging absence, negative thing. You can't be aware of yourself. And this whole idea that the mind is somehow emptiness, clear light, forget it. Wrong. Totally misunderstanding emptiness, okay? The mind is a positive event. The mind is a changing event. And emptiness is an unchanging event. And emptiness is a negative. It's an absence of something. To say that in any way that the mind could be emptiness, or that clear light is emptiness, that state of mind called clear light is emptiness, is totally against every scripture that was ever written in ancient India. There's no basis for that in the Kangyur Tengyur anywhere, okay? It's just made up, okay? Is there a thing called clear light? Yes. It's a word for this square peg, the state of mind which is perceiving emptiness. Sometimes emptiness itself is called the clear light. Is it light? No. Is it clear? No. Okay. Does this become clear light? No. And it's just bad translations, bad explanations, and then they got spread and like that. Okay. Did Michael Roach say there's no such thing as a clear light?
No.
No. Is there a clear light? Yes. What's it mean? Emptiness. Okay. Is it clear? No. Is it light? No. Okay. Is there a tantric state called clear light where you see emptiness? Yes. Okay. Is somehow your mind emptiness? No. Okay. Does your mind have its own emptiness? Yes. Can you see the emptiness of your mind? Yes. Okay. When you see the emptiness of your mind, do you see your mind directly? When you see emptiness of your mind directly, can you see your mind? No, it's not emptiness. Unless you're a... Only a Buddha can see their mind and the emptiness that the mind is seeing at the same time. Because they are two totally different realities. Think of them as two layers on the cake, you know, they're divided by this nice frosting, you know, they can't meet each other. Only a Buddha can perceive both at the same time. Okay, so forget, I mean, your job for the next few years should be to attack, go around the world and debunk all this stupid misinformation about emptiness. Okay, it's not green light, it's not what you see when you press your eyeball real hard, it's not some kind of black hole, it's not meditating on black, it's not trying to meditate on nothing. It's not watching your thoughts float in and float out. Is that an empty mismeditation? It can be, okay? Mahamudra can focus on your mind, and you can focus on your thoughts, and consider how they are projections of your mind, and that's a beautiful emptiness meditation. But just to sit there and watch your thoughts go on, come on, rabbits do that, bugs do that, lizards do that, okay? There's no benefit, okay? Did Michael Roach say that you shouldn't watch your mind? No, it's a very good meditation. You have to be considering is emptiness. Why even your thoughts are projection, which gets us to our subject. So those are the two kinds of non-duality. You can't be aware of the distinction between subject and object while you're in the direct perception of emptiness because the subject is lower reality. Okay? But that doesn't mean they don't exist. Okay? And both the subject and the object are equally empty of self-existence. So in that way, there's no difference between objects and subjects. That does not to say that they're the same thing. Okay? All right? Okay, here we go. Say Dachomba. Dachomba. Dachomba means arhat. Okay? Not the same as Arya, right? Arya is anyone who saw emptiness directly. Arhat is anyone who's attained nirvana. And now you know what nirvana means, which is which is what? It has two parts. Never leave out the second part, okay? Got rid of your mental afflictions forever because of what you understood after you came out of the direct perception emptiness. All that stuff I wrote on the board last night, okay, that's called sosotango. That's called the realization of the steps of the four Arya truths one by one, okay? So an arhat is anyone who's been able to do that. The Tibetans translated ar as kill the foe, okay? The ancient Sanskrit root is urkh, which means to be worthy. So sometimes you'll see Tibetan scriptures that say, arhats are called arhats because they are worthy of the prostrations and offerings of the whole world along with men and gods. You know what I mean? And then you have to be sensitive that they're making a pun there. Okay? It doesn't matter. Anyway, they have polished off their last mental afflictions. Okay? And the next part of the Diamond Cutter Sutra gets into this. Okay? Lord Buddha says, hey, Subhuti, are you an arhat? And Subhuti says, yeah, I guess I am, you know. And he finally admits it, you know. And then Subhuti says, but one thing, O conqueror, if I thought of myself as an arhat, I wouldn't be an arhat, would I? You know, and so what, Subhuti's not supposed to think he's an arhat? No, you know the punchline. From his own side, self-existently, okay. Now, then they start talking about arhats, you know. Then they get into a long discussion about arhats. And there's a certain point in your career when you're pretty close to arhat, and then a Buddha will show up, and they put their foot on your head, okay, and they say, on December 3rd, 2001, you're going to be enlightened. Congratulations, you know. You have to get to the eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi to get that prediction, okay. I don't know if it's quite like that. Supposedly they touch your head with their feet, okay. Probably they're up higher, sorry. Probably they wash their socks too. But anyway, they give you this prediction. You have to reach the eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is Nirvana on the Mahayana track, okay. Eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi. So Lord Buddha says, oh yeah, you're right about that arhat thing. You know, if I had thought of myself as an arhat, then Buddha Dipamkara, which is a former Buddha, couldn't have come up to me when I was still not yet enlightened and put his foot on my head and said, oh, you've reached eighth bodhisattva level, congratulations. You're going to be enlightened on such and such a day, okay? So that's how the conversation goes in the sutra right now. Now for me, the interesting part here is the whole concept of destroying a mental affliction. How is it that seeing emptiness is going to stop your jealousy, anger, irritation, anxiety, low self-esteem, pride, whatever it is, okay? How is it that you use that to destroy that? You know, I've been telling you about how to look at the boss, what the boss really is. We talk about the pen. I mean, for me, it's a burning question. My jealousy drives me crazy. What's the definition of a mental affliction? Uh-huh. Okay. No fun, everybody. All right. Rangi bengi kansaki shigi mashiro chepe semchun nyomongi tseni. Means the definition of a mental affliction is any thought which disturbs the peace of mind of the person who has it. That's all. In Sanskrit, klesha comes from a word klish. Klish means to bug somebody, to bother somebody. Okay? Klish. Don't klish me, man. Okay? And klesha means that. So how do you know if you have a mental affliction? You're unhappy. Okay? You're not at peace. Your mind's not at peace. That's a mental affliction. You know, you can call it deluded thought, you can call it negative emotion. I don't care what you call it. Now you know what it is. The technical definition. Any thought which disturbs the peace of mind of the person who has it, okay, is a mental affliction. Now, for me, who spent my whole life bothered by these things, every 5 minutes or so have my mind thrown into a little trough by some, you know, minor jealousy at someone or minor irritation at someone or maybe a major blow-up of anger or something. If you could say to me, hey, I can show you how to get rid of those things forever, you know, you wouldn't be capable of getting angry. You wouldn't be capable of being upset. You wouldn't be capable of having anxiety. You know what I mean? There would be something you couldn't... They say that in Buddha Paradise, they don't remember the word for these things. Like somebody says, Maitreya, what should I do about my pride? And he's like, pride. You know, he's like trying to remember what that was. You see what I mean? I mean, wouldn't it be nice, you know? So at this point in the sutra, Lord, actually a little later in the sutra, and I've thrown it into this part of the translation, he says, I'll tell you how to get rid of your mental afflictions, using the information in this sutra, okay? Then he says, once I was a Buddhist sage, saint, called Supamawa. Supamawa means Mr. Patience, okay? And I was hanging out in this forest in Kalinka, which is not far from here, I think, but I don't know exactly where it is. And it's one of the 24 holy places. And I was sitting under this tree trying to meditate, and the king of the kingdom and his wife were sitting around the castle talking about going out for the day. And the king said, well, I'm going hunting. And the queen said, I don't feel like slaughtering animals today. I think I'd rather pick flowers, you know. So she takes her handmaidens and goes out into the forest for flowers. He rides off with his bodyguard and to kill animals, deer. And then she's walking through the forest with these ladies in waiting. You know, I always see these long British dresses, you know. And she comes up to Supamawa and sees this beautiful saint under a tree trying to meditate and says, I've always wanted to ask a few questions. Probably it was about emptiness, but we don't know. And from someone who understood it. So I'm just going to ask him. So she sits down at a respectful distance and starts asking him questions about Dharma. And then he comes out of his meditation and starts to answer her. Then the deer decides to run that way, goes through the opening in the forest. The king rides by, he looks down, here's his wife all snuggled up against this Buddhist monk, you know, and he gets the wrong idea, you know. He thinks something's been going on. So he dismounts the horse, and he goes over to the sage, and he orders his bodyguards to take the sage. He's called the king of Kalinka, and they take him down, spread-eagled on the ground. Then he takes out his sword, and he starts to cut off his fingers, joint by joint, you know, slowly. And then he cuts off his hand at the wrist, and then he does the same with his toes and his feet, and then slowly he just decapitates him until he's dead, you know. So here's Lord Buddha, who is the future life of this saint. You see what I mean? That was one of his past lives. He was the saint who got caught up, you know. And he says, I'm going to tell you how it feels to be an arhat. You know, I'm going to tell you why I did the right thing. Okay? And he says, while the king was cutting off my fingers, and while I was undergoing excruciating pain, I never once had a perception of him as a duck. Okay? As a self-existent thing. Not once. You know, while he was cutting off my fingers, I was able to maintain the vision of him as being my projection. You see what I mean? Not once did I forget that. Not once did I think he was coming from his own side. You see what I mean? And because of that, I didn't hate him. And because of that, I had no wish to do violence to him. Okay? Meaning, it's the same in your office, you know? The guys in front of you, who? The collection of balls and cylinders and decibels, mostly decibels, right? And he's yelling at you. If you get the slightest feeling that he's coming from his own side, that he's angry from his own side, you will react with violence, okay? Which is number one stupidest thing you can do. Why? You are doing the only thing that will bring him back in the room in the future. You see what I mean? On the other hand, if you refuse to think of him as a person from his own side, you know, if you appreciate that he's a bunch of pieces of data and I'm seeing an angry person because of something coming up within me, and other people in the room are not seeing that, that's a proof, right? Other people in the room are seeing this great guy telling Michael Roach he should show up at work once in a while and not go to all those Dalai Lama lectures, you know what I mean? And so the fact that I'm seeing him that way is caused by my past hurting someone. So what are you going to do at that moment? If you could just remember emptiness for a few seconds, you see what I mean? In the heat of battle, while this guy's angry at you, which is the last time you can do it, you know, anyway. And you think, this guy's empty, this guy's a big, you know, bunch of colors and shapes, and I'm seeing an angry guy because I yelled at someone in the past. Then definitely what will happen? You're not going to yell back, okay? There's no way you're going to yell back. This is called, the Dalai Lama calls it enlightened self-interest. Okay? Enlightened self-interest. This is watching out for number one. Okay? That's, by the way, and to think that way at that moment is what it means to take refuge. Okay? You can Buddham Saranam Gacchami all you want in front of some flat painting of a Buddha, you know? And or Sangye Lakyabso Chiyo. I'm just saying in general, the idea that refuge is to sit in front of an altar and look at a flat painting and say, oh, Mr. Buddha, please help me, is the same thing, His Holiness said it, it's the same thing as going to some Christian church and looking at this cross and saying, oh, please help me, you know? It's not refuge. That's not refuge. It doesn't protect you. People were killed hanging on to Lord Buddha's arm during his lifetime. You know, his village was attacked. People came and grabbed onto Lord Buddha's arm and said, help me, protect me. And then people came in and stabbed them and killed them. That's not refuge. Refuge is when the boss is yelling at you, you say, this is happening because my mind is making me see it this way because of some kind of karma I did in the past. That came from yelling at someone. Now the stupidest thing I could do is to say something back unkindly. Then you shut up, and what happened? You just protected yourself. You just took refuge in the Dharma. And that's refuge, okay? You know, you got this refuge commitment, you got to do it 6 times a day. It's easy. How many irritating people you meet in a day? You know what I mean? If you do it right, you can do it 12 times a day, no problem. 20 times a day. If you're in a group like this, you know, okay. You're going to get all these chances to take refuge, you know. And that's protection. And there's no other protection, okay? That's it. You got to protect yourself, okay? That's an act of protection. That's an act of refuge. And now you have to take it all the time, okay? So, I'll run it by you again. Mr. Patience, Buddhist monk, while he's getting his fingers and hands and feet cut off, says, not once during that event did I think of the king as being something that happened from his own side. Da, self, Atman. I knew that it was just my mind organizing that noise into an angry man because I did something in the past. So intelligently, I kept my mouth shut. Okay? Now, what's the implications here? Very important. Did Mr. Patience's fingers hurt? Of course. You know? And then there's this idiotic explanation that somehow, if you're focused on emptiness, you can go to the dentist without Novocaine or something? Forget it. Show me this person. I still haven't had them come to class. You know what I mean? I'm going to do this drill thing on them. Okay? It has nothing to do with that. His fingers hurt a lot. Okay? They hurt a lot. Okay? So he did have that kind of suffering. Okay? But did he avoid the truth of suffering? We say he did because he didn't respond. You see what I mean? He didn't create new suffering for himself. He turned off the faucet, Kunjung Denpa, the truth of the source of suffering. He turned it off. So did the king stop cutting his fingers off? No, because it don't work that way. It takes time. Okay, you cut off the faucet now. Next year, you don't have a king cutting your fingers off. Okay, I'm sorry, there's a time lag. Arya Nagarjuna said, if there was no time lag, we'd all be Buddhist already. Okay? If the people ask me, can I step on roaches in my apartment? I say, you're asking Michael Roach? No. No, and then they say, if your ribs started to break, when that bug's ribs started to break, would you step on them? And they say, no, but they don't break. And I said, that's just the illusion of the time lag. Okay? The world would be totally honest and moral if there was no time lag. You step on a bug, your rib breaks. How many bugs would you step on? You know, maybe we'd find a way not to step on bugs. You see what I mean? Or everybody'd be going around like this. If the minute you lied to someone about money, your own bank account dropped by $100, would you lie? You see what I mean? Really, it does drop by $100, but it just takes a little time. Okay? And so that's all. To do an act of patience with emptiness understanding is that. Okay? Does it hurt when they yell at you? Of course it hurts. Does understanding their emptiness diminish the fact that it hurts? Not really. Are they unpleasant? Yes. Yeah, is it real? It is. That that illusion or that perception is going to cut your Christmas bonus. Okay? It's for real. Okay? The whole question is in the response. Okay? Is in the response. Link number one in the wheel of life. Link number one is where you cut it, is where you snip it. Ignorance, you know. I refuse to react ignorantly. You know? I refuse to talk back to you in the way I used to. Because I don't like you, and I don't want to see you again. Okay? The best way to get rid of your angry bosses and managers is to be good to them. Okay? It's so fantastic to watch them go. I can't tell you. Okay? One by one, picked off like birds on a telephone wire, you know? And you know, and you just be patient and sweet to each one of them one by one, and they will leave the company, they will leave your life, they'll be out the door. It's beautiful to watch. It's exciting to watch. Okay? Now, if this guy is actually causing trouble for other people and hurting other people, by this principle, are you supposed to sit there with your mouth shut? Not at all. Okay? Like, you're required to demand justice. Okay? If there's a wrong being done, your vows require you to act. Okay? You can even break the first seven bad deeds in extraordinary circumstances. If it's necessary to restrain someone with physical force, you're allowed to do it under special circumstances. Okay? But it's interesting. You're never allowed to break the last three, which are what? Mental. You see what I mean? There's never a case where having jealousy towards someone would be a noble thing. You see? There's never a case where being proud in a bad way could be a noble thing. So what I'm saying is the kind of anger and the kind of response I'm talking about is mental affliction anger. I'm not talking about social justice. You know, if the boss comes in and starts beating one of the women workers, you have to get up and pull him off. But what's inside? Happy. You know, joyful. Tsundru, joyful effort. You know, bam. Get off this lady. I'm not kidding. But if inside there's any mental affliction or any negative motivation, you'll have bad karma. If it's all totally for protecting this other person and you're very sweet-minded and you're treating the boss as if he was your own mother who went crazy for a little while, Pabongkor Rinpoche says, you went to work, you came home, your mom is baking a cake, she's cutting it with this big knife, and she says, honey, did you have a nice day at work? You say, yeah. And she says, would you like a piece of cake? And you say, yeah. And then she takes the knife and she comes at you. And she's about to thrust it into your chest, you know. Would you shoot her, or would you jump to the side, grab her, and wrestle the knife away? You see what I mean? It's your own mother. You see what I mean? He says the use of force to help other people has to be always done in those parameters. You see what I mean? This is your own mother. The boss is your own mother. And what peaceful, you know, or semi-peaceful ways can you restrain them rather than hurt them? You see what I mean? And that's all. So I'm not implying that you shouldn't do anything if there's an injustice being done. You have to do something. What I'm saying is that if you respond with anger to the king, you're perceiving them in the wrong way, you don't understand that they're coming from you, and you're just making another one in the future. In fact, you're making about 100 more. Okay? So that's all. That's how you get rid of your mental afflictions by understanding emptiness. Cool? That's how to become an arhat. Okay? And it works. And Nagarjuna in his Sorleka, in his friendly letter, says, there is no other way. All other methods are band-aids. All other methods are temporary. Seeing your enemy as your friend, you know, trying to be nice to everybody, temporarily thinking that a girl that you have desire towards is your sister, or trying to think of their poop and their earwax and everything else, okay? These are all temporary. He says, in the end, he says, they don't work. They break down. You must understand the emptiness, or you can't stop your mental afflictions forever. You must, okay? That's a rule. Are the band-aids useful? Of course. But they don't fix things permanently. Okay, one more question on your homework. What's the emptiness of an arhat's mind? Emptiness. No, but describe it a little bit. Huh? She said Buddha nature. Nah. It is, but... Oh, nice. Okay. He's projecting onto his own mind that he doesn't have any more bad thoughts. How's that? It's the same as the pen. Where's that pen thing? We're going to give up paramita, prajnaparamita. It's going to be the pen thing. Okay. It's the same thing as the pen. Okay. He hears words going through his mind. He hears sounds going through his mind. But he doesn't have the karma that's going to come up into his conscious mind and force him to hear those things as pride, anger, jealousy, desire. It's very interesting. You see? If you had good enough karma, you wouldn't have to see any pen ever run out of ink again. Because the fact that it runs out of ink is your own karma wearing out. There's nothing out there that's running out of ink. Okay? And the same thing with every bad person you ever met. If your karma, if you kept that book well, if you kept your vows well, you'd get to a stage, and check it out, you would never meet another irritating person in your whole life. That's worth it, right? And if you got even better at it, your karma wouldn't even project into your own thoughts any negative thought at all. And that's what makes an arhat, okay? It's all emptiness. Their mind is a bunch of sounds and a bunch of noises, and the great karma they have sitting there in their karmic pocket comes up to their mind and forces them to see the mind as being happy and clean and pure all the time. And that's how you get rid of your negative emotions. It's very interesting. If you understand karma, if you have a problem with depression, low self-esteem, anxiety, all these mental problems, there are specific karmas that are making your mind see them that way. And you can get rid of those karmas. It's very interesting, you know. All kinds of, you know, bad moods, irritation, jealousy, short-temperedness, anxiety, low self-esteem. All of those things are thoughts in your mind, parts, and your mind is forcing you to see them in a certain way. And you can turn that off. You can stop it. You see, it's very cool. Okay, you have to learn to do two things. A, find out which karmas caused the problem that you have. Okay, if you have low self-esteem, go to the karmic dictionary, look up low self-esteem, and figure out what kind of karma causes low self-esteem. Okay, step number A, and then avoid it in the future. Step number two, go back to all the old times you did it and destroy the karmas. We call search and destroy mission. You know, identify the karma that you must have done in the past and go after it and stop and blow it out. Get rid of it from your mind. You have a karmic pocket and you can go destroy karmas. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow, okay? How to go into your old karmic storehouse and destroy old karmas that you have. So if you take care of all the old karmas and if you don't make any new karmas, then that anxiety or that depression would just go away. Okay, it's very interesting. It's really cool. Let me see if there's anything else. The emptiness of the Buddha who's got his foot on the guy's head, the emptiness of the guy with the foot on his head, and the emptiness of the prediction, you don't have any problem with that. I don't have to explain that. Okay. Yeah, that's all. Okay. The bottom line is just be aware that the rules that apply to physical objects, this is not a pen from its own side, and it's not something to chew on from its own side, also apply to your own thoughts. Okay, because they're just another bunch of objects. Okay, and whether you have happy thoughts or unhappy thoughts is nothing in your control at the present moment. Okay, you cannot control it at the present moment. You will be forced to have whatever thoughts you have karma to have. You see what I mean? You're just watching them. You're a victim of your own thoughts. You're at the mercy of your own thoughts. If you're tired of hearing inside of your mind bad thoughts or unhappy thoughts, then do your book. You see what I mean? And then in the future, it just won't come. You see what I mean? It's very interesting. That's the emptiness of your mental afflictions. And that's the only way you can get rid of them. Okay. Did you have a question?
The karmic dictionary you're referring to, Wheel of Sharp Weapons, what other references should we be looking
at? Yeah, really nice, really nice. Where is the karmic dictionary? There's a book which has been translated as Wheel of Sharp Weapons. I prefer to call it the Crown of Knives, because it's actually a special helicopter blade, and you can see it in Sutra. In there, they give all the what I call the correlations. You have this problem with your back, then stop doing this kind of karma. You have a problem with low self-esteem, stop doing this kind of karma. You have a problem with depression, stop doing this kind of karma. And there's a whole list, and one of my students has organized it into a list. So maybe we'll try to print that? We'll try to print it out for you. That's one very good reference. Lamrim Chimo gives a very good list of correlations, and those of you who are in Kathmandu, you have that list. And the whole Vinaya, you know, the whole Jataka tales, the whole Avadanas. You know, people think that Jataka tales are for kids. People think that the stories of saints of the past are for kids. The reason Lord Buddha got up and taught something like 16 volumes about his past lives was for the correlations. Okay, that's all. He wanted you to understand that if you do this kind of karma, you're going to get this kind of result. And conversely, if you have a problem with your back when you meditate, here's how to get rid of that. You see, you go after this karma and you knock it out. Okay, so those are the places you can find it. I would work on the Crown of Knives. I would try to get that translation. Like, I think in Goa we might be handing it out. Okay, all right. Here you go. Oh, it's also in a business book that I wrote for. There's a book, two books coming out by Doubleday in February, and you can get them on Amazon, I think. I'm not trying to sell them because all the money goes to Sarah, by the way. 100% of the money goes to Sarah. But in there, there's a whole chapter on different karmas that come up in your everyday work life and how to prevent them karmically, you know, how to take care of them karmically. So there's a whole chapter on that. So I think by February you could get that. Okay, here we go. Yeah. Oh, the name of the book is The Diamond Cutter. It's called The Diamond Cutter, The Buddha on Managing Your Business and Your Life. And it actually has parts of the sutra and the commentary and how to apply that to business life and life in a for a working person in an office. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Thank you.